Thank you, everyone, for joining us for today's discussion on perspectives on the 2023 EULAR recommendations for systemic lupus erythematosus. This discussion is sponsored by AstraZeneca Medical Affairs, and it is intended for healthcare providers. Both speakers have been compensated for their time. My name is Dr. Leanna Wise from the University of Southern California, Keck School of Medicine. And today we will be discussing the EULAR recommendations for SLE and some key takeaways for clinical practice. Today I am joined by Dr. Richard Fury, who will introduce himself.
Thanks for the invitation to participate in this program. I am the Chief of Rheumatology at Northwell Health in New York, and also a professor of medicine at our School of Medicine, Zucker School of Medicine at Hofstra Northwell. So our first topic to discuss today is the updated 2023 EULAR recommendations for the management of patients with systemic lupus. Now, I was a member of the international task force that developed the updated EULAR recommendations. In fact, it was the very first time I participated in guideline development, and I must say it was a wonderful experience. The task force was composed of about 40 experts from all walks of lupus life. It was a huge effort and most professionally executed. So let me review the process and then we'll go into the recommendations. The goal of the project was to update the 2019 EULAR recommendations given the emergence of new evidence, including new drugs. A systematic literature review going back 5 years was performed and statements were formulated, which the task force further refined. There are two components to these recommendations: overarching principles and also specific recommendations. Voting took place, and if you take a look at the article published in the Annals of Rheumatic Diseases, you will see the levels of evidence, the strengths of the recommendations, and the levels of agreement of each item. So let's start with the overarching principles. I mean, these are very general concepts that should already be a part of good medical care. I can run through them very quickly. So number one was management should be multidisciplinary and customized according to a patient's needs. Education and shared decision-making were stressed. Disease activity and organ damage using validated instruments should be evaluated. The third item dealt with non-pharmacologic interventions such as sun protection, smoking cessation, diet, exercise, and bone health. And everybody felt that these should all be addressed. The next one was about pharmacologic interventions and that they should be personalized and guided by patient characteristics, organ involvement, risks of toxicity, comorbidities, organ damage risk, and patient preferences. And finally, early diagnosis, regular screening, prompt initiation of treatment aiming at remission or low disease activity, and strict adherence to treatment were all listed.
Thank you for that, Dr. Fury. So as an author on these updated guidelines, there's some key points that I'd like to discuss that were emphasized in the guidelines. And one of these in particular is the concept that prompt initiation of immunosuppressants or biologics should be considered pretty early on, not only to control disease, but also to facilitate glucocorticoid tapering or even discontinuation. I'd like to talk about that a little more in depth to discuss how we can do that better for our patients. What are your thoughts on these recommendations specifically in regards to starting immunosuppressants or biologics earlier in the treatment paradigm for our lupus patients?
One of the most important concepts in the treatment of patients with lupus is that active disease leads to damage and damage begets more damage. And there is one more step in this cascade, that is, damage accrual increases one's mortality risk. Therefore, it is so important to reduce disease activity and prevent flares. This means digging into the entire drug arsenal and being more aggressive with our therapies. And more aggressive not only includes introducing immunosuppressives or biologic treatments, but it also includes introducing them earlier to avoid damage. So in prior years, we perhaps introduced drugs sequentially, but now we can consider introducing both immunosuppressives and biologics together.
And I think I'll add one further idea too, is that not only does disease activity from lupus itself cause damage, but so does long-term glucocorticoid use. So I think we're coming at it from two different perspectives. We want to control disease, but we also want to get patients off of glucocorticoids. And I'll look at some patients and say, yes, the disease is fairly well controlled or maybe very well controlled, but we are relying on a lot of glucocorticoids to do so, or I think this patient might need more glucocorticoids in the future. And that's why I want to get immunosuppressants or biologics on board in order to spare them extra glucocorticoids long term, which the data is extremely clear has also been linked with damage, which, as you mentioned, is linked with mortality. So I'm going to ask a similar question. Are there patients that you might view as higher risk who may need more aggressive treatment earlier on in their lupus journey?
My choice of medications for a patient takes into account several factors. So for example, the medications that they're currently taking, the medications that they failed, potential toxicities, family planning, and then you have to throw in the pill burden, the route of administration. And I hate to introduce insurance pushback, but that's what we deal with in everyday life. So those are just some of the factors. But I make a point of explaining all of these issues to the patient and urge the patient to take part in the decision making.
Yeah, I agree. And that goes back to that first overarching principle that you mentioned for the guidelines, making sure that it's individualized, thinking about the patient in front of you, those who are particularly high risk, maybe those who are ethnic minorities, those who are at risk for severe organ damage, lupus nephritis, et cetera. So I'd like to move on to another major topic discussed in the guidelines, and that's minimizing glucocorticoid use long-term, which we have discussed a little bit already. So given the potential effects and risks associated with glucocorticoid use, the guidelines do mention that glucocorticoids should be reduced to a maintenance dose of less than or equal to 5 milligrams a day in patients with lupus, and if possible, withdrawn, which I think is fantastic. Again, there's very clear data now showing that long-term glucocorticoid use is dangerous and it's cumulative over time. So I'd like to discuss a few questions in regards to using glucocorticoids long-term. Are there specific techniques or ways that you like to discuss potential effects and long-term risks of glucocorticoid use with your lupus patients? And if so, how do you go about this somewhat early in your treatment strategy with your lupus patients?
Well, I explained that we've had a love-hate relationship with steroids since they were first introduced in 1948. And while they've transformed the treatment of inflammatory diseases, I am frank and I list many of the common side effects. And so I hope that I impress upon my patients that we will use them, they will help, but we need to reduce or even discontinue the drug at some point.
I fully agree with that. There's very little I want to add. And I agree with saying be as specific as possible about weight gain, risk for diabetes, skin thinning, peptic ulcer disease. But on the flip side, I don't want patients to stop steroids inappropriately either. And I think having them understand that, yes, this can quell disease activity quite quickly and we use them when appropriate, but getting into, you know, segueing into this idea of using steroid sparing agents is so important, and getting them off of steroids as quickly and as appropriately as possible is very, very crucial for good lupus care. So with that being said, what is your goal and approach with the tapering of glucocorticoids?
Well, my goal is to get patients off steroids, but it's easier said than done. Mm-hmm. For patients who have been on steroids for a long time, I taper very slowly because too quick a taper, patients won't tolerate it and it won't last.
Yeah, and I think patient education is also important. I think having the patient understand what to expect as they taper steroids and how to manage their other medications is important, because sometimes as you taper steroids, some side effects from, I'll use the phrase, maybe my endocrine colleagues won't always agree with this, but as their adrenals somewhat wake back up, they may have some other side effects. And I think having the patient understand what is a lupus disease flare and what are steroid tapering side effects is very important. So I think patient education is also helpful in tapering glucocorticoids over time. With that in mind, I think this next question is, how do you mitigate the risk of flares as you're tapering glucocorticoids for the lupus patients? I think this, we probably have to individualize this for each patient, but is there a certain way that you try to reduce flares as you're tapering glucocorticoids?
Well, there's no question that taking care of lupus patients involves a lot of science, but you know what? It also involves a lot of art. If you anticipate that your patient might flare when steroids are tapered, there are a few options. So you could taper slowly and just see the patient more frequently than usual. And the other thing that you could do is add or modify their other medications. So for example, add an immunosuppressive or a biologic that may certainly allow you to taper the steroids.
And from your perspective, how do you involve patients and how do you ensure that they're comfortable as you taper glucocorticoids? Because as you've mentioned, some of these patients have been on steroids for many, many years. I mean, some of them maybe even decades when they've come into your practice, maybe if you've inherited them from someone else. How do you involve the patients with glucocorticoid tapering if they're perhaps reluctant, or maybe this was something that was not even on the table for them and they thought, wow, I never thought I could actually get off of steroids. What are ways that you approach this and how do you talk about this with the patients?
Well, there's no question. Time is limited with each of our patients, but I try very hard to educate the patient and have them share in the plan. It definitely takes extra time, but I think it's worth it. So what I hate is when the patient says, whatever you say, doc, I don't like that. So I counter that I want to hear what they have to say about the plan. But again, this is a real challenge.
I think one thing that I would add is having the patient understand the idea of a steroid-sparing drug taking the place of the glucocorticoid and making sure that they're fully on board with the choice of that steroid-sparing drug and that they were involved in understanding the risks and benefits of that steroid-sparing drug, what to expect in terms of side effects, both short-term and long-term. And at least then they know that as that kind of switch or handoff occurs from relying on steroids for disease control to the steroid-sparing drug, that they were involved in that decision-making process. And I agree, you're trying to condense all of this into a 15 or 20-minute visit. That's very hard. And it might take more than one or two visits or a couple patient portal messages. But yeah, it's a lot going on in one visit. So a similar question along those lines. Are there certain concerns that you've seen patients raise or discuss when you're trying to implement minimizing glucocorticoids? Do you notice a theme or particular problems that patients report as you're minimizing glucocorticoids?
Perhaps the most common response from patients is that they tried tapering in the past and it didn't work.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're concerned that they might get more fatigued or they might have more pain. And I just urge them to forget the past and try to taper perhaps at a slower rate than previously. Or as you mentioned, you know, add another medicine, an immunosuppressive or a biologic that might be steroid sparing.
Yeah, I agree with maybe regrouping and trying a slower taper is often might kind of allay some of those fears. But yeah, I like that idea of let's forget the past and try again. I'd like to now talk about the 2023 EULAR recommendations for initiating lupus treatment aiming at remission, or DORIS, which I'll define in a moment, or low disease activity, or LLDAS, if remission is not possible. And I'd like to define both of these. So DORIS, or a definition of remission in lupus, is defined as a clinical SLEDAI of 0, a physician global assessment of less than 0.5 on a scale of 0 to 3, prednisone equivalents of less than or equal to 5 milligrams a day, and antimalarials and or stable immunosuppressive agents, including biologics. LLDAS, or lupus low disease activity state, is defined by SLEDAI 2K of less than or equal to 4 without major organ activity, a physician global assessment of less than or equal to 1, again on a scale of 0 to 3, no new features of lupus disease activity compared to last assessment, prednisone or equivalent of less than or equal to 7.5 milligrams a day, and immunosuppressive drugs and approved biologic agents at stable tolerated doses. So again, we have these two concepts here that are kind of similar to disease activity from other rheumatic states like rheumatoid arthritis, but now we're using these concepts also in the lupus arena. And these were discussed in the 2023 guidelines. So Dr. Fury, what do you think about using LLDAS and DORIS in practice with your patients, using these specifically, but also using the essence or these concepts in practice with your patients?
Well, for starters, LLDAS and DORIS aren't really treatment strategies, rather they're treatment goals. And I think most of us have been living by the concepts behind LLDAS and DARS. That is, try to reduce disease activity, try to reduce background medicines, namely prednisone.
Yeah, I agree that the essence of these, I think the vast majority of rheumatologists have been aiming for as long as they've been seeing lupus patients. I mean, getting people off of steroids and making sure that they don't have new disease activity when they're seen next. And when I first learned of LLDAS and DORIS, I think these are very admirable, but hopefully we are aiming for these even before LLDAS and DORIS came out. And now we have these really well-defined low disease activity and remission states. I think one overarching concept I take from both of those in terms of goals is really to minimize prednisone use. And again, just with the risk of sounding like a broken record throughout our discussion here, is the data is so clear. Let's get patients to low or no doses of glucocorticoids. And I think LLDAS obviously stresses this, but so does DORIS, of course, with getting patients, you know, can we get patients to zero? And this is something that I really stress with patients. You know, prednisone can save lives, but it also can cause damage and even mortality long term. So to me, this is something that jumps out as whether or not there's a defined remission or defined low disease activity. This is the essence of really good lupus care, is saying, what can we do to keep a patient safe and to control disease activity? A big cornerstone is minimizing glucocorticoid use long-term. And this is something that jumps out to me from these two treatment goals here. So Dr. Fury, when thinking about remission or low disease activity, are there certain barriers that may be patient-specific or health network-specific barriers that keep you from getting to low disease activity or remission?
Oh, I'd say we have several barriers, but the biggest problem for me, and I'm sure it's the same on the West Coast, is compliance and adherence. Mm-hmm. The typical lupus patient is young, and while I hate to generalize, we run into too many patients who don't want to take medicines, they don't want to see the doctors, and they don't come for their appointments. And frankly, I don't know how to solve that problem. So that's an impediment to achieving a low disease activity state. What do you do out there on the West Coast?
I'd say there's a lot of heterogeneity with our patients. I would say for sure we do have that component, because sometimes lupus activity is somewhat silent. As you know, you can have some smoldering proteinuria. The patient feels fine. Why are they going to appointments and taking these medications if they feel fine? But we also have patients who don't feel great, yet they still have their lives to live. They have, you know, three kids to take care of. They're trying to pay rent and hold down two jobs. And it takes three buses to get to our county clinic. And so I feel for those patients. They are doing their best, but there's a lot of structural and social determinants of health barriers that are in the way. And as you mentioned, they're young people. They're trying to go to school and have relationships and just live a normal young person life and manage a very chronic life-altering disease. I don't have a great answer of let's just remove this one barrier and all will be good. I wish I did. Yeah, it is difficult. And I think that there's work to be done. Dr. Fury, I want to ask you another question. Are there certain SLE disease characteristics or disease activity characteristics that you might consider when you're deciding on treatment targets? And do those disease activity characteristics alter your treatment choice?
Yeah, that's a really tough question to answer in a short amount of time, because there's no disease more heterogeneous than lupus. So therefore, we're dealing with a lot of different manifestations. But despite this challenge, the goal, regardless of the manifestation, is to see an improvement without worsening in another lupus domain. So whether they have skin disease, arthritis, or for that matter, kidney disease, we want to see disease activity settle down.
Yes. And going back to the heterogeneity of lupus and individualizing lupus care, I think it's so important to know the patient in front of you. How have they responded to their past regimens? How are they responding to their current regimens? And I'm thinking about these ideas of the formal LLDAS and DORIS and the physician global assessment. And sometimes it just really helps me to know, being in Los Angeles on the West Coast, how sometimes I'll just ask my patients, what are you doing for fun right now? Are you going to the beach? Are you going hiking? How are you taking care of your children? I want to know, how are they living their lives? How are they functioning? How are they doing their ADLs? And this is giving me a good idea of, you know, what is this 25-year-old woman, this 30-year-old woman, how is she functioning in the real world? Is she actually getting through life in a healthy way, or is she really bogged down by lupus activity? And I think, to me, the better I know these patients, the more I know about their lupus disease activity in the past, how they're functioning right now in the past 2 or 3 months, I think this really gives me this idea of how we can individualize care for these patients.
Okay, so whether you're on the West Coast, the East Coast, or somewhere in between, the concepts are the same. The concept that rises to the top is the fact that disease activity is responsible for damage accrual. And the damage can either be from the disease itself or from drug toxicity. It's been shown by many investigators that increases in damage increases one's mortality risk. This message is very crucial. And so I would say 3 key takeaways. 1, intervene early. 2, consider immunosuppressants or biologics at any point, especially early, and try to achieve a state of low disease activity or even remission. And for extra credit, I'll even throw in a 4th bullet, and that is, don't forget about the patient, make them feel better. So I'd like to thank those listening to this podcast. I hope you found it valuable.
Dr. Fury, thank you so much for joining us today. It was a great discussion, and I appreciate your insight.